This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll talk to author and relationship advice columnist Dan Savage for his appearance at the Connecticut Forum, where he'll be part of a panel called Being Gay. But first, Dr. Joycelyn Elders is an outspoken advocate for public health issues. She was appointed as the first African-American Surgeon General during the Clinton administration. Then she was fired from her post for some frank comments about sex and AIDS prevention. She joined us last week while she was speaking in Hartford as part of a Connecticut Health Foundation forum about health equity in the media. I asked her what she thinks about the role of journalists in covering the health disparities between white and minority communities and whether she thinks the media get it.
I think the healthcare journalists, some of them, are excellent. And they really have done a wonderful job of researching what's going on and know what they're reporting and what you read and what's out there is excellent. Others are not as informed and do not do a job quite so well. But I feel that I look at journalists as really having a, I don't know if it's a responsibility, but a role of really educating the people in the community on the day-to-day activities or on what's going on. You know, we read our newspaper or listen to our radio or look at our TV, however we get the information. Well, we depend on you to bring it to us.
So when we talk about healthcare inequities, what exactly are we talking about? What's the story you would want to get out to people about health inequities in America today?
The story I would like to get out about health inequities in America today is, first of all, that they're there. We have them. And we've been trying to correct them for years, or saying we want to eliminate the health disparities. But we have not. And the reason we've not is because sometimes it's because we don't know. You know, we just, many people are the people who can make a difference, don't know that they exist. And we have different cultures. We're the most diverse country in the world. And we have more than 300 different languages. And we have to understand that if patients don't understand the doctor, they can't do what the doctor says. And many times they'll be saying, yes, ma'am, yes, ma'am. And they don't even know what we're talking about. And we have, sometimes we have doctors, you know, we have disparities in regard to the doctors. You know, our doctors are no different from the rest of our society. And so we know we have all of these isms. And so we have to overcome our isms sometimes in reporting. And we also end up with the disparities, let's say, in our system. We have a system that's not equitable for all people. We know rich people get better health care than poor people. We know that educated people get better care than uneducated people. We know that it depends on where you live. We learn no more about the life expectancy of a child when it's born or 5 years old, depending on the zip code, than we would know if we knew their genetic code. Mm. So we know that these things are going on, and one of the things that health equity does is try and make sure that everybody has an equal opportunity or access to health care. Some of our people, I tell people all the time, if African Americans, if we don't hurt and we don't need bleed, we aren't sick. We don't need to go to the doctor. Yet we are dying earlier from hypertension, stroke, cancer, diabetes, some of the things which are preventable if they were picked up earlier.
Well, but let's talk about that distinction, because I think that this is important. When you talk about these simple facts that rich people get cared for better than poor people, and people who are more educated get cared for better than people who are less educated, that sets up some systems understandings that maybe the society can deal with. But the thing that you're talking about now is something else, which is it's based along racial and ethnic lines as well. Black people in America Hispanic people in America have worse health outcomes. But it's not necessarily, Dr. Ehlers, because they're poor, and it's not necessarily because they're less educated, but in part it has to do with race as well. So how can you talk about that for us, and how do we make a change about those racial health disparities and ethnic health disparities, not just the economic ones?
Well, some of that is related to the things that have gone on in our society forever. We just don't look at them in the same way. We don't go in as early for preventive health care. Some of it is because we didn't know it was important. Mm-hmm. Some of it is because we didn't want to spend the money going to the doctor for that. Mm-hmm. And our culture has been such that we didn't grow up to look at keeping our body healthy. We dealt with do something about it when you get sick. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about it when you're healthy. You're all right. You can't afford to spend money that you only have for milk to go to the doctor when you're just well for a checkup. So it's our attitude, and I feel of the big mistake that we're making that we could fix fairly easily. Mm-hmm. We need to have comprehensive health education as a part of our schools from kindergarten through 12th grade. We need to be taught how to be healthy. Mm-hmm. And that's not something we're taught. You know, many children get it. You know, you can say, well, the rich children get it at home. But not necessarily, but they might. More likely than children from, let's say, a teen mom who doesn't know about, you know, educating her children. So to make sure that everybody gets it, we need to have comprehensive health education in schools from kindergarten through 12th grade. Like things like good nutrition, exercise, 20 minutes every day. You know, if you don't do it and start doing it before you're 10, you'll probably never do it.
Well, and as a society, it seems as though we're talking more and more about healthy eating than we ever have. In large part, you know, the efforts of First Lady Michelle Obama, she's been doing outreach and trying to get people talking about this. But getting to your career as Surgeon General, it seems as though something we were scared about 40 years ago, 20 years ago, and now today, is talking to kids about sex.
Yes.
We don't want to talk about sex
to
our kids because there's a large segment of our population that thinks that if we talk about sex, then they'll have sex.
That's exactly
so,
right.
So how do we get over that hurdle? Because if kids don't understand issues of contraception, they don't understand issues of how they are growing up sexually, we're going to have more problems, and nobody seems to want to address this.
It's amazing. Other countries, the reason we have the highest teenage pregnancy rate, even though our teenage pregnancy rate has dropped 45% since the, you know, in 1990, we still have the highest teenage pregnancy rate in the industrialized world. Mm-hmm. And that just says how high our teenage pregnancy rate is relative to other countries. The major difference, they educate their children. They're honest about it. That empowers them with the knowledge so they can make responsible decisions. And it's been shown that children that have good sexuality education are they're less likely to have sex. And if they do have sex, they're more likely to use a contraceptive. So we have to teach them to be responsible. We can't just assume that they're going to go out there and do the responsible thing.
Do you think that this is a particularly acute problem within minority communities? We're talking about health equity here and health outcomes. Do you think it's a particularly bad problem?
I think it's a bad problem in our whole society. You know, it's just, we don't just have minority children having children, but the minority children having children is twice as high as that for the white community. But the white community in America is much higher than that of European countries.
It's interesting. You know, there's a lot of things that we excel at here in the United States. And there are certain things in which we lag behind. You're talking about a teenage pregnancy rate, talking about incarceration of people we have a much higher rate of incarceration. And again, this seems to be something that falls squarely on the backs, in large part, of the minority population. What do you think it is, Dr. Elders, that keeps us from providing that kind of education? Because it's education along the way, right? If you're educated more at an earlier age, you're less likely to end up in jail. If you're educated early in an early age, you're less likely to have a child as a teenager. What is it, do you think, in your long career, about our systems, about our society, that keeps us from understanding this, keeps us from doing what a lot of European countries have done?
You know, that's somewhat hard to answer, in that I think we have a problem in our country with our religious community has not always been on board. You know, they have been, if you tell them about it, they'll do it. You know, everybody, all parents, really believe in abstinence. And then they're so abstinent until we don't tell our children anything. And that allows them to get in trouble. And whereas we won't take care of preventing unplanned pregnancies, but, you know, and then we talk about how we're such a great country and take care of the children after they're born. Well, we want to have planned, wanted children. And I think it's our religious community has just got to get out and begin to help us get that message out.
But what's interesting about that, again, it comes back to some of these health equity issues, because the religious community that you talk about, that religious community, often the most conservative religious communities reside in the Hispanic community, in the African-American community.
Yes.
Not across the board, to be sure, but within those communities, there is a certain resistance to the very things that you're talking about. So as you go out and talk to people around the country, what is it you're telling them? How is it you're able to engage the church communities to say, look, you're part of the solution here. You can help us.
Well, I think I really go out and tell them about the problems and tell them it's their responsibility, and they help create this problem, and they've got to get involved. They've got to educate their parents on how to educate their children. They've got to get out and help us get comprehensive health education in schools for those children who don't come to their church on Sunday. And then we've got to learn more than one A word. We've spent all of our time talking about abortions. The idea is, I've said, I'm not about abortions. I've never been about abortions. But I've been about preventing unplanned pregnancies. And I've never known any woman to need an abortion that was not already pregnant.
That's Dr. Joycelyn Elders, pediatrician, public health administrator, and the first African-American appointed Surgeon General of the U.S. Elders was in town last week to speak at a Connecticut Health Foundation event. Coming up, she'll recount her experience surrounding the controversy that caused her to lose her job in Washington and talk more about the importance of sex education. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up, we'll talk to Dan Savage about his take on sex ed and the upcoming Connecticut Forum conversation on being gay. But first, we sat down with former Surgeon General Joycelyn Elders. She was in town speaking to a panel convened by the Connecticut Health Foundation. It was about health equity. I asked her about her career in Washington and about why she thinks she was fired by President Bill Clinton, who had recruited her for two top jobs. First as health department director during his administration in Arkansas, then later as the first African-American Surgeon General.
Let me just say up front that I really feel that the President Clinton knew exactly what I was about before I went to Washington. We'd been working very hard on the problem of teenage pregnancy and issues in Arkansas before I came. And he said, well, I want you to do for the nation what you did for Arkansas, and trying to increase awareness and get schools, churches, everybody around involved. And so we talked about all the different things that we could do. When I was fired, I was at the UN, and they was talking about how we could prevent AIDS. And obviously, you know, they talked about abstinence and, well, we, you know, the A, B, C, D of AIDS prevention. A for abstinence, B, be faithful, C, use a latex condom, and D, do other things. And so I was asked about whether I would recommend masturbation. And I said, well, you know, I feel that we've 80% of men masturbate at 90, and 70 to 80% of women masturbate, and the rest lie. But one of the things we have to know, masturbation does not cause hair to grow on your hands. Mm. It does not cause you to go crazy. Does not make you go blind. Mm-hmm. Certainly you won't get pregnant, and you know that you're having sex with somebody you love. So that created a very massive uproar in Washington, as if people had never heard of masturbation. And but you know, I feel that the president was doing what he felt he had to do because of all the uproar that he was getting from the people, you know, other politicians around. And I never felt in any way that he was, you know, he felt that I had necessarily said or done anything wrong, but it was just not acceptable in Washington at that time.
So, and obviously without getting into the very obvious things that happened to that president in the intervening years since then, some of which had to do with sex. There is something, though, that President Clinton has actually come out and talked about recently. You know, he signed the Defense of Marriage Act while he was in office. And he's recently said that was essentially a mistake. This has been overturned now. And we have a much different attitude in America toward gay people marrying.
Yes.
I'm wondering, do you think... And I don't know how often you talk to President Clinton, if you feel as though his mind has changed over not just DOMA, but some of these other issues you talked about, whether or not you think that he's evolved in his thinking since this time in which, frankly, Doctor, he let somebody go who was saying the truth about what's going on in America and how we can solve a problem.
Right. Well, listen, there is no question that I never felt that President Clinton not feel that I was telling the truth. I never felt that. I think he was having problems within and around his administration, and this was creating a lot of chatter. Maybe I should have stayed, and then they could have kept fighting and having throwing darts at me, and they would have ignored, you know, what else was going on. But that's not. I just feel that his cabinet or people around felt that this was what he should do, and he didn't have time to worry about it, so it was easier to let me go.
In the last few years now, we've talked an awful lot about people making great strides in the African-American community since Barack Obama was elected president, and we talk a lot on our program actually about, you know, have we entered a post-racial society where, you know, where racism doesn't really exist? Well, obviously that's not the case. But I want to go back to your career and your place in this. Do you feel at all as though you were a pioneer in some way in the work that you did?
In regard to teenage pregnancy, I feel that I really spoke out. And I feel that the people that had been working in the teenage pregnancy prevention area felt that I was right. They were out there doing the research. I was more the mouth, you know. I was doing the talking. And I was really involving a lot of people that had not wanted to say anything before. I felt was very proud of what I was doing. And that is that they often say, I spoke the truth to power. It was not that I was making up lies, and I was using their data to talk about, which they could not talk about. So I in that sense, I was a pioneer.
But how about as a leading voice in healthcare for African American women? At the end of the day, a lot of the issues we talk about, and we bring it back to health equity, that befall so many people in America, it falls so squarely on African-American women, women who are raising children by themselves, women who don't have the same health care as the rest of society, who aren't able to make as much money as the rest of society. I guess I'm wondering if you can talk about that, because this is still an underserved community, perhaps the most underserved community in America.
Yeah, I feel that African-American women have been what I would call the beast of burden, if you will, for a very long time. They have, you know, have been poor. They've not been educated. They have usually had very, you know, been in low-wage jobs. They've had to live in poor, often toxic-infested neighborhoods. They were trying to take care of their children. We didn't want to tell them about contraceptives or even pay for contraceptives. So, and our country still in no way pay for abortions. So I'm just, I feel that African-American women have really struggled very long, very hard, and hopefully now they're beginning to come into their own and recognize some of their rights and power, that, you know, they were often being in abusive of families, they were being beaten, and so I'm very pleased to see so many bright young African American women doing as well as they have, and I've struggled hard to try and mentor them, to push them, and I feel very strongly about that. And you know, I thought that my talk about pregnancy. If they became parents as teens, they didn't get an education, not have an opportunity to become a part of society. And, you know, and I worked hard to make sure that they, after they became pregnant, they could go back to school. You know, so those are things that I'm really very, very proud of.
I'm talking to you just a week before the official rollout of the healthcare exchanges that are a part of what's colloquially called Obamacare, but what's known as the Affordable Care Act. And there's been clearly a lot of controversy about its implementation. Right now, there's a Congress that wants to essentially defund it and take it off the books. From both a positive and negative standpoint, I guess I'm wondering if you can tell me what you think of the Affordable Care Act, some of its pluses and maybe some of its weaknesses, where maybe it doesn't go far enough.
Let me tell you, I feel that we've been trying to get health care in this country for over 100 years. Of all the developed countries in the world, we're the only developed country that does not have health care. If we don't like Obamacare, fix it. Don't try to throw it off the books. And I think that if our politicians would spend the time to try, and let's work it out, and let's fix it so that it's equitable for everybody. The people that would most benefit, are the young, the poor, the African-American women with children would find it most beneficial, but also African-American men. So, we've got Medicare, you know, we have people walking around saying, well, I don't want the federal government interfering with my, but I've never heard anybody say, I'll give up my Medicare. Mm. We're all proud of it, and we want it, and every citizen in America should have a right, a constitutional right to health care. So, in that sense, I feel it need to go as far as it can go. We need to keep people healthy. That's far cheaper than letting them get sick and try to fix them after they're sick.
But when you talk about the industrialized countries that we compete with on the global economy that have these systems in place, the systems are all very different. But many of them are different than the plan that this Obamacare presumes, and no matter how much anybody wants to say that there's a socialist aspect to this, at the end of the day, this is very much a capitalist format, and it's not necessarily going to be a whole heck of a lot cheaper for a whole bunch of people. Yeah. Dr. Elders, do you think that we should move as a country toward what's known as a single-payer system, one in which the federal government has a larger role in people's lives, but more people are covered at potentially a lower cost with all the pluses and minuses? Do you think that single-payer is the way to go?
I think the single-payer would be far better than what we've got. Since nobody wants to talk about single-payer or do anything about single-payer, well, you know, at least let's get started. We keep throwing everything out and not moving forward. At least Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act, whatever we call it, it gets us on the road and gets us started. And no, it won't be cheaper for some people. But do you know what? We've got the best sick care system in the world. The problem is we don't have a health care system. We don't keep people healthy. And that's what we need to be looking at and trying to do. And I think that Obamacare at least begins to address prevention and how do we keep people healthy. You see, if I get real sick, it doesn't matter whether I have money or not. The best hospital in Hartford will take me in and take care of me until they can move me somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
But they won't provide me preventive health care. And so I think that that's where we're going to see the greatest rewards from this, is that we will have a healthier population and therefore a healthier community, which will make the cost, you know, we talk about access and we talk about cost, I think, in the Obamacare. And I think that those two things will improve access, will decrease cost, and I think the quality will be the same or better.
Dr. Joyce Lynn Elders, thank you so much for spending some time with us. I really appreciate it. It's great to meet you.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Joyce Lynn Elders is an endocrinologist, professor emeritus at the University of Arkansas School of Medicine. She served as Surgeon General under President Bill Clinton. She currently spends a lot of her time as a public health educator. She was in Hartford speaking at an event sponsored by the Connecticut Health Foundation. Coming up, Dan Savage talks sex ed and previews this weekend's Connecticut Forum on Being Gay. More information at ctforum.org. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, Yale history professor Paul Sabin will join us to talk about his new book, The Bet, Paul Ehrlich, Julian Simon, and Our Gamble Over Earth's Future. It looks at an iconic wager between a famous biologist and an iconoclastic economist to look at the clash between environmentalists and their conservative critics from the late 1960s all the way to the present. I hope you can join us. Dan Savage is well-known author of Savage Love, a sex, love, and relationship advice column. He's also an activist and founder of the anti-bullying project It Gets Better. You can find more at itgetsbetter.org. He'll be in town this Saturday speaking as part of the first Connecticut Forum of the season called Being Gay. Dan Savage, welcome to Where We Live.
Thanks for having me.
Now, in a bit, we're going to be getting to some of the topics that you'll be discussing at the upcoming Connecticut Forum, but I want to start by talking about something that was brought up by our previous guest on the show, former U.S. Surgeon General Joyce Lynn Elders. One of the things we talked about was the need for better sex education. It's something that you frequently discuss. I guess I'm wondering if you can just give us a grade, first of all, as a society and how we're doing educating people about sex.
Close enough. Outside of a couple of private schools and maybe the UAA's sex ed program, which is actually very, very good, we do a terrible job. We don't really even teach sex ed in places where we think we're teaching sex ed. Some of the sex ed programs that people hold up as examples are good at what they do, but they're not doing sex ed. They're doing education around reproductive biology. Kids leave those classes knowing how a baby is made and maybe how to avoid making one, but they don't really have a sex education. We don't teach about pleasure. We leave pleasure out of the conversation when that is almost invariably the reason why people are having sex almost all the time throughout their lives. People have a small handful of children, if they have children at all, but they have a lot more sex than that. Even social conservatives will have more sex than they have children. And it's about pleasure, and we don't teach about pleasure. We don't teach about it to such an extent. There's a really interesting study out of the UK where they interviewed young people who were sexually active and found that many of them were having sex that was unpleasurable, uncomfortable, even painful, but they didn't know that that was a problem because no one had told them, because they hadn't been educated properly, that sex is supposed to feel good.
What?
And so they were doing things that felt bad, and they didn't realize that there was anything wrong with that equation.
So what do you think is at the root of this, of why we don't want to talk about it, why we don't want to teach it?
Some people have it in their heads that if we teach really comprehensive sex education, that people are going to run out and do everything that they've heard about. Oftentimes, it's people flying blind into their sex lives who get hurt or do things that were ill-advised, that they're uncomfortable with. Hearing what, you know, one of the things that's not covered in a sex ed class is homosexual sex, and that should be covered because some significant percentage of the kids in those classes are going to be gay or lesbian or bi when they grow up, and they need to know about the mechanics of same-sex sexual expression, exactly the same reasons that the straight kids need to know about the mechanics of heterosexual sexual expression, but it's not taught for fear that that will somehow turn straight kids into gay kids, which is just not going to happen, and it is not the truth. It would be good for the gay kids for sex ed to be taught, even gay sex ed to be taught, even to the straight kids, because it would demystify same-sex sex and make it harder to demagogue about and less stigmatized and less shameful, and that would be healthy for everyone.
I'm wondering if you think, though, that over your career, the reasons why we don't talk about sex more productively in society, whether or not it's changed, because I think you and I probably grew up at a time when words like the moral majority were something that we actually heard in the news, and we thought that there was a different attitude towards sex in the public sphere, that you saw very different things on television. There was no internet, certainly. I guess I'm wondering if you think it's changed at all in your career of covering and writing about this issue. Are reasons why we still don't get into it, even though it seems like so much else in society has changed?
Well, I think that a certain amount of sexual discomfort is almost hardwired into us. And it's almost as if in every generation we have to overcome the stigma and the fear and the shame, because there's almost something natural and inherent about it. You know, you think about when you were a kid and you heard about these things that adults do and did, you were a little revolted and disgusted at those birds and the bees talk, a little shocked when you heard about sex that first time. And then, you know, you grow up and suddenly your puberty hits, and suddenly you want to do these things that you had previously, pre-puberty, decided were icky. And you have to overcome that kind of built-in inhibition and sex shame to get through it. So I almost think that plays out on a grander scale with each successive generation, that we have to continuously unlearn and push past and move through this sort of sex hang-up that is almost hardwired, almost unavoidable, you know, as individuals and then collectively kind of on a mass scale. It's funny, though, that I was going through school papers that my mother saved for me, and I found from fourth grade in Chicago in a Catholic grade school in the 70s a sex ed test that I was given in fourth grade that was really comprehensive and covered a lot of things. And it does seem like schools got more skittish after, you know, the moral majority wave and politicized right-wing evangelical Christianity crashed over the country in the 80s and 90s. And schools got a lot more skittish, even Catholic schools, about what they would and wouldn't teach because it was suddenly so contested and controversial. Now, though, we don't have the ability or luxury, we don't have the ability to raise kids in ignorance about sex. We don't have the luxury of neglecting sex ed because there is the internet and there is internet pornography. And for a lot of kids who have no sex ed, internet pornography has become their sex ed. And if you don't want your kids getting their sex education from internet pornography alone, you have to educate them about sex. You have to counter the messages they may be getting from pornography that are unrealistic and a bit warped. I don't want to engage in smut shaming any more than slut shaming, but pornography is not an accurate portrayal of human sexuality and sexual expression any more than action movies are an accurate portrayal of how people drive in cities. So we need it. We have to overcome this cultural skittishness about teaching sex ed, because it's going to rile up the religious conservatives, who are always riled up anyway, so we might as well err on the side of riling them up. They enjoy being riled up, because if we don't give our kids a sex education, they're going to get it exclusively from pornography, and it's going to harm them, and they're going to harm each other and their partners when they become sexually active.
Well, one of the things that was interesting to me about my conversation with Dr. Elders previously was the fact that, and I think you're quite right, and you and I grew up at the same time period, that when right-wing Christians began talking more openly about sex in the way they did in the 1980s, it did seem to change something about the American expression of sex for some time. That said, you know, Joycelyn Elders was fired by Bill Clinton for talking about masturbation, for talking about ways in which kids could have a sexual experience without causing harm to themselves or anyone else. And it seems as though it's not really exclusively a right-wing problem. It seems to just be an American problem, a problem that we seem to have a hang-up with that maybe a lot of the rest of the world just doesn't.
Well, some people would argue that Bill Clinton was a terrific Republican president. Even some people argued that at the time. So maybe he's not as left-wing as, you know, now he's regarded as being. You know, he signed the Defense of Marriage Act. DADT was passed under his watch. He fired Joycelyn Elders. He was skittish on these issues of human sexuality and sexual expression. And what Joycelyn said that, you know, Surgeon General Elders said that got her fired was that we should teach masturbation. Absolutely, we should. And as someone who's out there in the trenches, as I am, listening to people talk about their sex problems and young people talk about their sex problems, people can really mess up their entire lives sexually by masturbating incorrectly as children. People can carve a groove into themselves that's very deep. You know, there are people out there who, you know, boys in particular, who masturbate in ways that leave them incapable of climaxing with an actual human partner. We need to say to boys, we need to say to girls, we need to encourage girls to masturbate too, that you need to masturbate correctly. Here's how you should masturbate so you don't render yourself incapable of responding when you transition to partnered sex. That shouldn't be controversial. That should be something I should be able to say on the radio. That should be something I should be able to be said in the classroom.
But how do we realistically teach it in the classroom in today's America? I mean, what's the right way to do that so that we get the message across, but you're also skipping over a lot of the other very obvious right now political hurdles that would come with what you just said?
There's this terrific program I wrote about in American Savage, my new book, where in this class they teach the basics. They teach reproductive biology, they teach contraception, they teach about sexually transmitted infections. And then there's a question box where the children who are taking this course, the young adults, high school students, can ask about anything. They can ask about, you know, if they have a disturbing sexual desire or a non-normative one that isn't disturbing, but, you know, if they have a kink, and young people can be kinky, just like young people can be gay, lesbian, bi, or trans. They can ask anything. They can ask any question, and it will be answered. And that's a terrific program in that not only do kids who are taking this class get to have their questions answered, even if it's a subject that, you know, if the course instructor himself or herself raised of their own accord might shock parents, but it puts into the minds of everyone taking the class that they have a right to ask questions and that there are answers out there for them, and that they shouldn't be ashamed of having a question or having a concern, and that the right thing to do is to ask and listen and learn and find out the info that can help them. And that's a terrific model. You know, I don't think that even in a comprehensive sex ed class, everything can be covered. But you could have a class, you could have a model for a sex ed course in which every question that the kids in each particular class have, that every one of those questions can and should be answered.
We're talking with Dan Savage, who's the author of the advice column Savage Love, the founder of the It Gets Better campaign. He's also on the panel of the first Connecticut Forum of this season on being gay, and you're listening to Where We Live. I've been talking with a lot of people recently, Dan, on the program about race and racism in America, and this idea that after one term and now getting through a second term of a black president, that we're in some sort of a post-racial era. And it seems as though for many Americans, because DOMA has been repealed, Don't Ask, Don't Tell has been repealed, that we are in some sort of an era that is more friendly for gay and lesbian people. But for a lot of young people today, it's not a very friendly place. I guess I'm wondering if you can just sort of give a temperature right now in America as you see it. If you're growing up LGBT, what it really means for you versus what maybe a lot of the straight community might think.
Well, first, I don't think we're in a post-racial America. I'm sure you don't either. You're just stating that.
It's one of the things that I hear over and over again from people, that's for sure.
Well, invariably what you're hearing, I think people are using the fact that we've elected a black president as an excuse to no longer admit to the fact that we still have, you know, racists and there are still racial issues that need to be addressed in our country. And that's, it's a ruse and it's a fig leaf. And the fact that we've elected a black president is certainly a sign of great and tremendous progress, but it's not an indication that there is not more progress that needs to be made. And I'd say the same thing on gay issues. It's gotten better for us. You know, the right-wing myth is that any progress is too risky. If we give women the vote, the family will collapse, which was the argument they made against, conservatives at that time made against giving women the vote. And they were wrong about that. And so, you know, we have right-wingers now arguing that, you know, if we let gay people marry, the family collapse. They're going to be wrong about that, too. They're always wrong. But the right-wing myth is that any progress is too risky and dangerous and will cause the sky to fall. The left-wing myth is that there's been no progress. That we're as racist or sexist or homophobic a culture as we have always been, and that is demonstrably untrue. And, of course, the election of the African-American president is proof that we are further along on issues of race than we have been historically. We have further to go. That there are now legally married gay couples in 13 states is evidence that we've come a long way on LGBT issues. We have further to go on those issues. And in some ways, for LGBT youth, it's gotten worse. David Sedaris wrote a terrific essay for the It Gets Better book, saying that when he was young and gay, that nobody called him gay because nobody knew what gay was. And so he was able to be kind of a weird, effeminate kid and fly under the radar, and nobody suspected him of being gay. And now, with sort of much more heightened awareness about the existence of gay people, the weird kids, the queer kids, the effeminate boys and the masculine girls, some of whom are straight, are all suspected to be gay and are all in some places persecuted for being gay, sometimes by their own families, with tragic result. And so, you know, it's a time where it's gotten, you know, crazy better for people like me who are out and gay and living in big tolerant cities like Seattle and have full civil equality. But for that queer kid who's 13, 14 years old and growing up in a rural area or a small town in a very conservative family or in a very conservative culture, in some ways it's gotten worse for him.
I'm wondering if you could give me your thoughts on what we recently heard from the Pope about perhaps changes in his mind about how that church might deal with gay people and also some of the other issues that he brought up. It seemed as though almost every Catholic that I've talked to has said, well, this is something we were waiting for from a long time. From where you sit, Dan Savage, what did you think of what the Pope had to say?
I think what the Pope had to say was great. I'd love to see the Catholic Church in America start to listen to the Catholic Pope in Rome. You know, in the wake of the Pope's statements on marriage, you had another Catholic high school fire a teacher for being a lesbian. You had a Catholic college disinvite a speaker, John Corbino, who was coming to speak on gay marriage. You still had the Catholic Church, you know, in its actions and its deeds in America, obsessing about this issue. You know, and I think we need to move past that. You know, Jesus was on earth for a while, had some things to say, but apostles wrote those things down, and he never talked about gay marriage or gay people. Jesus himself, and I say this as a Catholic and a former seminarian, really prioritized helping the sick and helping the poor. Yet you would think, if you were just to look at the church and look at the activism of the Catholic Church and the political activism of the Catholic Church in America, that Jesus, during his time on earth, did nothing but rail against gay people and gay marriage and abortion and birth control. This obsession with sex has kind of brought the church into disrepute and made the church look small-minded, anti-Christian even, certainly a little bit psychotic and crazy hypocritical, because while the Catholic Church is running around trying to regulate the sexual conduct of even non-Catholics in the United States, they can't seem to rein in their own priests who have been engaged in appalling behaviors sexually, sexual abuse, rape, and the attendant cover-ups. So I'm gratified by the remarks the Pope has made. I hope they sink. I hope they trickle down to the archbishops and cardinals and bishops, who are all appointed by his immediate predecessors, who were rabid social conservatives and obsessed about sex and abortion and gay people and gay marriage to a degree that is unhealthy. and I'm Christian.
Yeah. How do you address people who think that because you speak so clearly and so forcefully against some of the true problems you see in organized religion, there are many people, Dan, who see you as anti-religion, and so you must be somehow anti them because they are religion. And maybe talk about separating that and having the conversation with people who have faith themselves and who maybe don't like some of what you say. It's always a difficult balancing act, because one of the things that you're talking about is not bullying and being open to people saying what they feel. But at the same time, I think some people may interpret some of the things you say as being destructive toward their religious belief. How do you address them?
Well, everyone's entitled to their religious beliefs. You're not entitled to being coddled for your religious beliefs. And if your religious beliefs dictate that I must be persecuted under the law, then I'm going to have to push back hard against your religious beliefs and point out the hypocrisy where it exists, perhaps, in your religious beliefs. You know, when Christians say they have no choice but to oppose same-sex marriage or adoption rights for same-sex couples or any legal protections for same-sex couples at all, or even the existence of gay people, which is one of the things the religious right runs around doing back in this ex-gay movement, trying to encourage gay people not to be gay, or put it into the heads of straight people that the problem with gay people is that we exist at all and we don't have to, which is kind of genocidal a little bit, flavor of genocide there. To then point out, well, you say you have no choice but to take those positions because the Bible, well, look what else the Bible has to say about slavery, and you ignore that. Look what the Bible has to say about women and menstruation and clams, and you ignore that. Well, can you ignore what the Bible says about me in the same spirit that you ignore what the Bible says about people owning slaves? And if not, why not? And to confront people with that when they are justifying their bigotry with the Bible is not to be anti-religious, it is to be rigorous and consistent and anti-hypocrite. I am not I'm not an enemy of people of faith. I don't spend a lot of time running around the country condemning people of or calling out people of the Baha'i faith. It isn't Baha'i communities that are organizing to strip people like me of our civil equality. So there's no reason to get into an argument with them about the particulars of their faith. When people are pointing to the particulars of their faith to justify your political persecution, you have to get into an argument with them about the particulars of their faith. There's no avoiding it.
Dan Savage, it's a real pleasure talking with you, and I can't wait to see you at the Connecticut Forum this week. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Dan Savage is author of Savage Love, a sex, love, and relationship advice column, and he's also an activist and founder of the anti-bullying project It Gets Better. He'll be at the Connecticut Forum tomorrow for a panel on being gay. More information at ctforum.org. Where We Live is produced by Tucker Ives and Betsy Kaplan. The senior producer is Katie Tolarski. Our interns are Greg Dyson, Garrett Connolly, Albert Gordon, Tess Aronson, and Corey Breen. I'm John Dankowski. Have a great weekend.